Philosophers, historians, anthropologists, and poets, for centuries, all have agreed that the human voice is the oldest and truest instrument. Aristotle wrote that nature gives us the power of producing melody by means of our voice, and we naturally use singing before we learn the instruments. Rousseau wrote that the first language of mankind was song. The first expressions of passion were cries. The first poetry was music. Maybe it was put most plainly by the German composer Richard Wagner, who wrote that the oldest, truest, most beautiful organ of music, the origin to which alone our music owes its being, is the human voice. Wagner wrote those words in the late 1860s. 100 years later, and about 300 miles west of where Wagner lived, Theo Bleckman was born. Singers sometimes say that they are instruments capable of imitating the sound of other instruments, that the voice can be the bass or the flute, the drum or the trumpet. But you could also say that every instrument on the planet is an emulation of the human voice, because the voice doesn't just make sound, it moves. It's our first form of transportation, a way to send ourselves through space, across time, from one body to another. To make any sound at all, the first thing that has to happen is the breath travels through the body. Singing, at its core, is movement. So when Theo Bleckman, growing up in 1970s West Germany, decided that he would make his voice the primary mode of transportation in his life, he wasn't joining any tribe or consigning himself to any category. He was joining a great cosmic migration. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Theo Bleckman has spent decades living in the space between categories, between careers, between composition and improvisation, even between apartments. Born in rural Germany, he trained as both a boy soprano and a competitive figure skater before coming to New York at 23 to study with the legendary singer Sheila Jordan, and quickly he found a home among musical misfits. Since then, he's built a singular life in music, one that balances jazz, avant-garde experimentation, composition, performance art, and teaching. His new album, Love and Anger, produced by drummer Ulysses Owens Jr. and released on Sunnyside Records, revisits some touchstones from his past, his ongoing partnership with guitarist Ben Maunder, his reimagining of the Beatles, his love of Kate Bush.
Here comes the sunshine, here comes that sun of mine, here comes the everything. Here's a song and a song for you, sweet kisses.
It also reaffirms his belief in collaboration, curiosity, and emotional honesty. He tells me that the record came together only when friends reminded him, this is good. Stop doubting yourself. Along the way, he tells me what it means to live a life in music rather than have a career in jazz, about the changing landscape of education and social media, and about the deeply human need to listen to music, to one another, and to oneself. When we sat down recently, I was honestly a little intimidated. He's such a pure artist, someone guided by curiosity rather than commerce. But within 5 minutes of meeting him, I realized that what people say about Theo is true. He makes everyone around him feel seen and supported. Talking to Theo, one idea kept coming up again and again: the importance of community and the need for a network of support and encouragement. You need people to hold each other up, he told me. Even he, a mentor to so many singers and students, said that without encouragement from his husband, his producer, and his friends, his most recent album might not have gotten finished. And he told me about how he met his mentor, Sheila Jordan, when he was still a teenager living in Germany, and how she was the one who told him he could have a future as a singer. He told me, it's so important that somebody you respect tells you you've got something. I came from this cow town. I didn't know. Me, as a gay, white jazz singer, do I have anything to say in this music? Do I have a place in this music? And Sheila was like, you know what? Yeah, you can. You could. You will. I see that today in my 14-year-old daughter, Sol, too. She's so encouraged and supported by her teacher, Rosie Bullen, who just happens to be a former student of Theo Bleckman's. I see how important it is for Sol to have an advocate, someone to encourage her, to hold her accountable, to support her musical development, and to expand her sense of musical community, too. We found Rosie through Musication. Musication provides in-home music lessons in Brooklyn and Manhattan for children ages 3 and up. The teachers are highly experienced professional musicians, and every lesson is built around each student's individual interests and needs, with flexible scheduling to fit every family. What I've loved about Musication is that Sol's teachers, and she's had quite a few since she started as a little girl, have always met her where she is and kept her curious and engaged with music. Musication is based in Brooklyn and Manhattan, but you can reach out to see if they serve your area. Email lessons@musication.nyc and mention The Third Story to receive 2 free trial lessons. And while you're at it, check out Rosie Bullen's music wherever you listen to music. Third-story.com is the place to find the archive, hundreds of deep dives like this one, including the conversations with other accomplished vocalists like Michael Mayo, Janis Siegel, who actually gets a nice shout-out in today's conversation. Also, Kurt Elling, Satchel Vasandani, Joe Laurie, Samara Joy, Sage, Stella Cole. Visit the Substack at leosidran.substack.com for new episodes, essays, and updates. You can support the project there, too. It's also the mailing list where you'll be notified whenever a new episode drops. And remember, The Third Story is made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios to find out more about their award-winning content, including The Third Story, which is the winner of a 2025 Silver Signal Award. In fact, I'm going to the ceremony tonight. Here's me and Theo Bleckman moving the breath and talking it down. Theo Bleckman, who's going to start?
You're going to start.
Okay, I'm going to start.
Yes.
Well, I should tell you, you've already put me at ease in the last 5 minutes since you walked in the house. I've wanted to talk to you for a long time, and I've thought about calling you, and honestly, I'm intimidated.
What?
And I ask myself, okay, why are some people intimidating to me, you know? And I've been trying to sort of pinpoint what that thing is, whether it's because you're prolific or because I can't quite point you in a specific circle. Like, mm-hmm. I think of you as both an artist and also as an educator and somebody who's been so influential to so many people that I love and know. Or if it's because I think you're like a proper artist. Like, I think that you take a lot of chances and you don't exist in a very commercial space. Mm-hmm. There's so much about what you do that is just sort of like, I want to get it right if we're going to talk,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I was really careful about, or just cautious about reaching out to you until finally we just had this opportunity of a new project coming out. I thought, okay, fine. But I also want to tell you that in an effort to do my due diligence, I reached out to some mutual friends of ours to see if they had any advice. And the first person I asked was my daughter's piano teacher, who I know was a student of yours because you just posted about her yesterday, Rosie Bullen.
Oh my God, Rosie. And I love Rosie.
Rosie's here once a week teaching my daughter.
Oh my God.
And they write songs together. She's so creative. So I talked to Rosie and I said, you know, what do you have to say about Theo? And she said, he's the reason I live in America. He's the most incredible person I've ever met. And I thought, okay, well, this doesn't help calm me down at all, you know. Then I reached out to our mutual friend Riley Mulherker because I knew that you had worked with the Westerlies, and I asked him for some insight, and he just sends me a picture of you officiating his wedding. I was like, damn, this is like even more intense than I thought.
I had never been more nervous than officiating his wedding. I was so nervous because that is a big responsibility. That's a once in a lifetime.
Yeah.
If you screw up at a gig and you know, you miss a thing or this or that,
yeah,
you do it again or, you know, it's, but this was epic.
What I learned in my outreach, and that isn't even all of the outreach I did, but just to get to the point, is that you are so important in the community and people just have such a deep love for what you do. And it seems like so much of what your work is actually almost extra musical. It's this interpersonal part of your life.
Yes, 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 yes. Because when you do the things that I do or that Rosie does, which is not an instant commercial or Instagram, TikTok, viral sensation kind of music, you have to have some kind of community to support each other. Because it's a very tough road. Over the years, it's a long haul, and if you think you have to do it by yourself on your own, you're just gonna crumble, I think. So we need to hold each other. Mm-hmm. We need to support each other, hold each other up, and that's why I'm having some of my former students over tonight, mm-hmm. you know, for drinks, and then we go out to hear some jazz. Just because there's so many good singers now, so many good musicians, of course. Of this younger generation. And I think it's more daunting than ever to become a musician or a singer, jazz singer especially.
Yes.
So I'm trying to encourage the next generations to keep going.
One of the things that Rosie said to me about you as a teacher is that you were very focused on helping your students identify the thing that they do, mm-hmm. rather than being kind of generic.
Yes.
Everybody singers. It's yes. like each person has an area.
Yes, that is not the quick fix to stardom, yeah. obviously. I think of being an artist as creating your own computer language. Mm. So you could either learn Photoshop and execute it really well, so you can learn jazz and do all the right inflections and sing all the right repertoire with the right musicians, and everybody's going to clap and it's going to look and sound great. Mm-hmm. Or you can learn how to code and then create your own program.
Yeah.
And that's really what I'm trying to get into my students, is to figure out what they want to do, no matter how far-fetched or how far away it is from what my aesthetic would be. Because mm. that's the ticket to longevity and to a fulfilled life in music. I always laugh when I hear my students talk about a career in jazz. It's so absurd. Career. That sort of suggests that you climb up a ladder if you do certain things and then you get a promotion. And for me, it's more a life in music is mm. much more how I think about it. I'm so grateful and fortunate that I have a life in music.
Yeah.
I'm not famous, but I always have a gig somehow. It's weird.
That resonates with me so much. I think it was actually during COVID when I realized that some of my friends, those who have careers, were comfortable. I mean, it was stressful for everyone, but mm-hmm. there were some people that had their job the whole time, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. And I realized, oh, some of us are really on thin ice, and others are kind of more stabilized. And as you say, climbing a ladder, there's a hierarchy, there's an infrastructure mm-hmm. to support you. We're really out here alone.
Yeah, yeah. Especially if you're doing something even slightly unique or slightly off. You know, yes. you don't have to reinvent the wheel. But just doing something that's personal and not popular necessarily.
Yeah. I want to just briefly sketch out your journey. Mm-hmm. I just said, when you live a life in the arts, you're on thin ice. You actually started out on thick ice.
Well, I started out as a boy soprano and uh-huh. a guitar and a pianist as a child. And then I was always a really good skater. And I, during my voice break, which started around 11, 12, I think, I whined long enough to my parents that they would drive me to the nearest skating rink, which was an hour and a half away. It was a long drive. And
because you were raised in rural Germany?
Yes. Yes. It was a little cow town with a church in the middle. And so I got into figure skating, and I did it quite seriously for a while. Ice dancing. This was for those who remember Torval and Dean, 1984, sorry, Evo Olympics, mm-hmm. the Bolero. I mean, that changed my life. So ice skating was very, very important, but music, when my voice came back, I started singing again.
This is during your voice break, so yep. there's a period of a year and a half where you were no longer able to sing the soprano part.
Yes, exactly. So then I was like, oh, singing is over. And I went into figure skating and gymnastics. Mostly more seriously in figure skating. And I did that till I was 19. And around 18, sort of my voice, 17, 18, I connected with some classmates in high school, and they were jazz musicians. The way I learned about jazz, this is so bizarre, is that a good friend of mine was a clarinet player, and on a school trip, he brought his clarinet and he played Take Five on the bus, just the melody. I'm like, what is that? Wow, I want to know what that is. And then because he was a clarinetist and a saxophonist, he turned me on to Miles Davis and John Coltrane and, you know, all the instrumentalists. And that's when I got hooked to jazz.
What were you listening to musically? Was it for music for skating before that, or just popular music?
Kate Bush, yeah. and more Kate Bush.
Okay, well, we'll get there.
It was sort of pop music, I guess. Yeah. You know, ABBA as a young teenager.
Yeah.
I don't know, just trashy Euro pop.
What was it about Kate Bush that did that to you?
Kate Bush was sort of my refuge, sort of the thing that you have somebody that understands you, you know, sit in your room and you listen to the kick inside over and over again. It was the quirkiness and the collage. I knew that there was some artistry that was beyond anything I had heard, even though I mm-hmm. didn't understand all the references whatsoever.
And did you speak English?
Good enough. We had it in school. Yeah. So I could understand what the songs were, but I didn't really know what they were about in the end, but I knew this was a love song, or this is, you know, this, that, and the other. I don't know. It was just the weirdness. There was also a lot of, she came out with videos, and there was she came from pantomime. Uh-huh. She was a mime and from dance. So to me, that also incorporated this weird idea of strange music and dance.
Yeah. What were the sexual politics of rural Germany at that time? Did you know you were gay? Were you able to be out?
No, I wasn't. I kind of knew I was gay, but I didn't want to admit to it. I still had girlfriends. I was dating. Even when I moved here, I was still dating women. But the only time that homosexuality was mentioned was on TV when there was a crime somewhere. Mm. And they would say... And the victim was found in the homosexual milieu in Munich or something like that. It was always seedy and creepy and just, it didn't exist in any other way.
Right. You wouldn't see it. Nobody would talk about it.
No. There were magazines at the train station that were gay magazines mm-hmm. that I would sort of secretly look at once in a while and make sure nobody saw me kind of thing.
Yes.
And that's the extent of it, really. There wasn't much. You didn't have a cell phone or anything, you know?
Right, of course. So you said this clarinet playing friend of yours plays You Take Five and then turns you on to all this other stuff. Singers, though, or not really?
I listened to Bobby McFerrin's The Voice, which had just come out, I think. And I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. And I started to transcribe some of the stuff and try to sing it myself.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Boom, do, do, boom, do, do. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. Boom, do, do, boom, do, do. For your life. Boom, do, do, boom, do, do. You were only waiting for this moment to arrive. Beep, beep, beep. Blackbird singing in the dead of night.
The record that really changed me was Al Jarreau's Look to the Rainbow. Those two LPs were on constant rotation.
Stop and take a little time out with me. Well, just take five, just take five. Just stop your busy day and take the time out to see that I'm alive, I'm alive. Although I'm going out on my way just so I can pass by each day. Not a single word do we say. It's a pantomime and out of time. Still I know all eyes are for me. I feel tingles down to my feet. When your smile gets much too discreet, it sends me on my way. Now wouldn't it be better not to be so polite? Well, you look good, offer a light.
And also, Vocalese, the Manhattan Transfer, put out that record, right?
Oh, I love that record.
I thought it was just...
When you dig it on the map, virgin, let's go backwards, really close enough to get virgin. I'm not backwards, back a long time ago, they saw a rose, looks made of bones, soon that nose was old.
Have you talked to them about it? Have you talked to Janice about it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've given Janice an earful about how much that record means to me.
Yeah.
I don't see it mentioned very much. I think it was a milestone. Yeah. It's incredible. Those were my singers. I had a John Hendricks record. I had some Mark Murphy. I was looking for Mel Torme, of course.
So you did. You had a lot. You found a lot.
Yeah. I was always, even as a kid, I was always really, really good at imitating sound, making any sound that I hear. Meredith Monk called it vocal photography once. She said, "Theo, you're a vocal photographer." I'm like, that's really very accurate. I could make a lot of sounds, but I didn't know how to organize them, really. And Al Jarreau, to me, was a humongous breakthrough because he blurred, even more so than Bobby McFerrin to me, he blurred the line of where words begin, end, and come out of something else, where percussion goes into a word or becomes a word or becomes a sentence. That freedom and that playfulness and that joy, capital letters, J-O-Y, that Al Jarreau has in his singing, carried me through all the records. Like, I listened to all of his later records, even if they were, you know, more pop or funky, more produced. Didn't care.
Yeah.
Love
Just want to hear his voice.
Yes, love him.
The thing about that blurred line between the words and sounds is interesting, too, because, you know, I guess it raises a question as you move on in your career and your life, making choices about what you want to sing and whether or not wordless things can be as meaningful or can express the same way as the words do. You obviously choose repertoire where the words matter, and mm-hmm. then you do other repertoire where there's no words.
Yeah.
And as a singer, you have that option.
Yes, and you should use it. I mean, in working with Meredith Monk for many years, I've sort of come to a much deeper understanding of not singing with words. Not singing with words is not being an instrumentalist. And when somebody says your voice is an instrument, I'm wincing a little bit because it doesn't imply that I'm now imitating a trumpet or now I'm a trombone or now I'm a doom, 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 now I'm a bass. I think the voice can carry a lot of a lot of emotions that are beyond words, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I want to carry that over into jazz as well, you know, not just contemporary music. The no words thing is an interesting thing because when I moved to New York in 1989, all I wanted to do was sing the most complicated, avant-garde, hard to do, nobody's ever done, no words kind of music. And I did. Mark Dresser, I don't know if you remember.
I know the name.
Started a band called Force Green with Dave Douglas mm-hmm. and Phil Haynes and Demnon Maroney, all these super high-end avant-garde players at the time. And Mark wrote music, sent it to me, and I seriously thought that his printer, his Matrix dot printer, had a hiccup or a fart. This is impossible.
Yeah.
And I loved that. I loved that at the time, to find something that is impossible to do and then do it or figure out a way to doing it. I'm not in that place anymore. Mm. I've done a lot of it.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a few people that I can do this with, and Ben Maunder is one of them. But it takes a lot of dedication and practice. And I remember walking around the subway with a cassette player just to get used to the melodies. I mean, it was so atonal and it was rhythmically so challenging.
Yeah.
That it took me 3 months to learn this music.
And what do you think was attractive to you at that time in your life about doing the impossible?
It was this idea of Charles Ives going up the hill on the steepest incline. Like, that to me was, that felt like I was doing something. I was doing something bigger than myself. It wasn't about me, but it was just conquering something that hadn't been done before.
At the same time, you discover Sheila Jordan.
Hey, mama, what dat dare? Hey, why dat under dare? And oh, mama, oh, hey, mama, hey, look it over there. Hey, where they going there? Hey, what they doing there? Hey, mama, can I have that big elephant over there?
Well, I discovered Sheila Jordan before I came to America. She was a main reason for me. So if I'm Rosie's reason, then Sheila is my reason.
Yeah.
She helped me tremendously in that she invited me to stay at her apartment. Uh-huh. I had a scholarship from Boston, which I didn't take because I wanted to be in New York. Yes, so Sheila Jordan, I discovered on a strange whim. I opened a jazz magazine in Germany, and there was a tiny, tiny ad about her coming to Graz, Austria for a workshop. Uh-huh. And I took three trains, a 15-hour train ride, auditioned for her class. And to my great surprise, I got into a class of six people out of like 70 auditioners. I'm like, what is happening? And so Sheila and I immediately connected.
Yeah.
And when I heard her, I remember sitting there, like, I was frozen. Time was, it was just an apparition. She was so connected to something that I was just in awe of her and still am.
Do you think that passing that first hurdle of being selected among all those people gave you a sense, oh, maybe there is something here?
Yes, 100%, Leo. It is so important that somebody that you respect says, you got something. Mm-hmm. And honestly, you know, says so. Because I came from this cow town. I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know.
Is this, am I any good? Do I have
Me as a gay, white, jazz singer, do I have anything to say in this music? Do I have a place in this music?
Yeah.
And Sheila was like, you know what? Yeah, you can, you could, you will. And that was, you know, that took a while to, that seed needed to grow and grow and grow and really take hold in me. But that was very instrumental.
Yes.
Very important.
Was she focused on repertoire?
Very much so. Repertoire and sort of connecting to something really, really honest.
Mm.
I mean, you can't have a more pure, honest vocalist than she was. She was not interested in career or getting ahead or being liked or whatever. She just loved singing.
Yeah.
And she loved people. She loved students. She loved everybody equally. Which is the biggest legacy I can think of, besides her music, which is incredible. But she loved equally. So if there were students that were terrible, there were students that were famous, there were students that were super successful, that were connected, and somebody that was a beginner, she loved them equally.
Hmm.
And she gave everybody the same amount of love and attention, which is an enlightened state of being to me.
Yes. Yes, I've thought about that, about allowing to give yourself equally and fully in every situation that you go through, like stripping away all of your own, you know, preferences or prejudices or hierarchies.
Yeah, and you're not good enough for my friendship or something like that.
Yeah.
None of that.
Yeah, yeah. So she was the reason. How old were you when you came then?
I was 22, and I had to do 2 years of conscientious objector service because it was still, the draft was still on. And when I was done, I want to get out of here. and I'm glad I did.
The other piece of your childhood is that you were adopted, but close with your adoptive parents?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
I was very close. I mean, my father died when I was here, so 23. So I didn't really have much of a adult life with him.
Yeah.
But my mom died in 2016, so I was very close with her. Yeah.
I read that you felt like you were like a little bit of an alien, that you had been dropped out of kind of nowhere.
Yeah. I always felt that I was in the right family, of course, because I was loved and well taken care of.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel like these people were my people. Not my parents. I mean, the surroundings.
Yes.
I felt this is not quite, it's not a fit.
Yeah.
I'm not staying here.
I mean, I've often thought about what it means to leave your country and go somewhere else. And there are, you know, any number of reasons that people might do it, seeking opportunity, economic, whatever. But often it seems like those who are primed for that are the ones who, for whatever reason, are not a fit wherever they came from. And so it's easier for them to say, I'm going to just reinvent this, or I'm going to do this somewhere else.
New York is partially a bunch of misfits.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of people that felt that way.
And I like it that way.
And was it a fit right away? Did you find a place for yourself in the community here when you first got here?
And you know, I came to New York. First of all, I had Sheila, which was great. And Sheila introduced me to other people right away. But it's not even that. I came here and I knew this is it.
Yeah.
And I didn't care if I was going to become famous or successful in any way. I was like, if I can just live here, I'm going to be happy.
Yeah.
And I say this to all my foreign students when they move here, because a lot of them are moving here out of career opportunity reasons. And I think that's not always going to play out well, because if you don't get that, or you get to play with whomever and make a record, and then you're still not happy here.
Yes.
You have to really like living in New York.
Yes. Right. And I heard you kind of allude to this earlier also, that maybe, you know, maybe it's the same conversation we keep having about education in general. You know, there's just more. There are just more people who have figured out that this is a thing to do.
Yeah.
And so you know, part of that is, well, I'm going to study this and do this, and then I'll have a career, and then, as you said, yeah. and then I'll make money or whatever. And it's like the previous generations, and maybe you belong to one of the last ones, did this out of some compulsion or something that magnetism that called you to it that was yeah. not about how am I going to make money.
Yes, but I'm also very aware of the fact that now young singers have to make a living somehow, because resources are, you know, drying up through all, you know, Spotify and all that stuff. So for them to really push through on the internet and really go viral or something like that, I can understand it.
Yeah.
I'm here to offer another way of doing this. I'm not saying you shouldn't be doing this. You shouldn't be learning Photoshop and execute yeah. it beautifully. We need people to do Photoshop.
Is there a way to do both?
Sure. Yeah. You can do Photoshop and you can code your own thing.
Yeah.
Of course. I'm not anti anything.
Yeah.
I'm stunned at the quality of singing these days. It is so good. And Rosie yeah. is one of these examples. And I'm just like, what is happening?
Yeah.
And some of these young singers that I have are different. They're not the Photoshop yeah. executors, and they don't know that they have a right to exist even. Because there are so few people that encourage artistic behavior
yes.
right now. Everybody's an artist anyway, yeah. but true artistry also means that you're going to search for something and that it's not instant gratification kind of.
Yes.
Sometimes. So I don't think that that's an option for a lot of kids now. They just see the success of the few, you know, people and think that they don't belong.
Right. If you make work, how few people have to engage with your work for it to matter? Or how many?
Yeah. I had a concert once at Cornelia Street Cafe in which I was subbing for a singer who had gotten really sick.
Yeah.
And it was a duo concert with a pianist who shall remain nameless. Hmm. And it was a snowstorm, but two people showed up at this first set, and it was a snowstorm and it wasn't my gig, mm-hmm. but still two people showed up. And once we started the music, which was very, very out there, avant-garde kind of stuff, they started arguing with the bartender to get their cover charge back, and they left.
And that's just
and there was
you.
Nobody.
And then there were none. And so is it a gig? I mean, that's an interesting yeah. thing. It's like, is it a rehearsal? Is it a gig?
I don't know anymore. I mean, you could be brilliant in your living room for 40 years and yeah. then somebody finds your tapes and it's the best thing they've ever heard, or not. It's not so much to me. It's, of course, you need an audience. You need yeah. to have people. But also, are you really feeling in tune with yourself when you're doing it?
Yeah.
And if the answer is yes, then by all means do it.
Yes. And it matters.
And find a way to make it, either you get another gig to finance your music, or you find an audience.
Yes. You mentioned Meredith Monk, but it seems like that was another revelation for you along the way.
Yes. I knew coming to New York that I wanted to do something weird and different right away. And I knew at that time that singing bebop or jazz standards, even though that was my diet for many, many, many years, especially under Sheila, I didn't feel that I had arrived to do that yet. I needed to somehow accumulate some more, I don't know, like colors or something. Like I didn't feel equipped to sing this music yet. And so I went through through avant-garde and atonal wordless stuff. I went through free improvisation and electronic improvisation.
Yes.
And I met Meredith Monk in 1993 or something like that. Hmm. And she invited me to her 50th birthday party. And we danced together, and she said that that was my audition.
The dancing?
Yeah. She said, she already knew that I was a jazz singer because I'd been performing with Kirk Nurok, mm-hmm. a wonderful composer and jazz pianist. And she had heard about these gigs that we did through a friend. And so she claims that that was sort of an audition. And as soon as I saw her work live, I was like, I want to do that.
Yeah. What was it about it?
It was the It reminded me a little bit of Pina Bausch's work in that you don't know exactly what it's about. But you know it's about something very profound that touches
you. See, this is why I was afraid to talk to you. It's exactly that feeling of not knowing what it's about always, but knowing it's about something.
Yes. And I think, to me, that's where I'm the happiest.
Yeah.
I think art or music is often lacking in mystery.
Yes.
And I think it's our duty to insert mystery where there isn't any. I mean, Klaus Oldenburg is doing that. I saw a poster.
Yes.
I love his work.
Yes.
And there is so much whimsy and mystery about his work. That's not just clever or ha-ha-ha gimmicky, but that sink, that kitchen sink that's made out of this vinyl that's sort of collapsing like water is genius. I think about that all the time.
Hmm.
So for me, that's really where I see myself.
Yes.
Bringing mystery to something where there isn't really much.
It's so interesting that was the thing that because you just helped me identify the thing that scares me. I mean, I tread lightly. I just don't know. I don't know what my criteria is.
Yeah. And not everything that's atonal and difficult to listen to, let's say, is avant-garde or good.
Yes.
That's not it's not a qualifier. At the time that I moved here and I was young and eager to do something, I wanted it to have some aspect of challenge. That's, mm-hmm. let's say it
yes.
like that. And Meredith's work definitely is challenging on a lot of levels, physically and emotionally. And it brought together my love of movement and performance and, of course, singing complex music with other singers, which I, as a boy soprano in a choir, loved singing with other singers.
Yeah.
It was there's nothing like it.
Hmm.
There's a feeling of unity and connection when you sing with each other. You know this.
Yes.
You can't replicate that.
Yes.
There's a very nice, beautiful saying in German, where people sing, there you should settle down, because angry or mean people don't have song. Or don't have songs. It's not quite true, we know that. But in general, when you sing, you're happy.
You mentioned Ben Maunder also and the relationship. You said he's somebody that you're willing to continue to go complex and deep and granular with. That's a long, long relationship.
Yeah. I mean, if Ben Maunder doesn't get the MacArthur Genius Award, I don't know who will. I mean, that guy is unbelievable. I saw him perform at the old Knitting Factory, and I said, this is the guy I want to work with. So I had a gig at Cornelia Street Cafe, not the gig that I was talking about earlier. And I wanted to do it in duo with a guitarist. And I called him and he didn't call back. I was like, oh, damn, maybe he doesn't want to do it. And then I called somebody else. And then Ben got back to me. He was on tour and he didn't get the call. And he said, yeah, I would love to do it. He didn't know who I was, I think, because I was nobody. And so we got together and instantly we felt a connection, like right away. I could sense it from him.
Yeah.
We were so excited. And then over a couple of years at Cornelia Street Cafe, where we had a regular gig, we developed our repertoire and our thing a little bit. And then we've been in each other's projects and also, you know, helping or encouraging or blowing wind into your sails. Mm. You know, like, it's not easy. It's not easy for Ben Maunder. It's not easy for anybody to put out this, you know, incredible work and stay on it. And half the time, you don't know if anybody's listening to it.
Riley Mulherker pointed me to this arrangement that the two of you did, or I don't know whose arrangement it was, this recording from one of your early records of I Remember You with Ben. Because you're talking about how there was a time when you had all this repertoire from Sheila, but then you also were looking to do something. I'm listening to it, you know, for the first 30 seconds.
You're the one who made my dreams come true.
And I'm thinking it's just like a lovely rendering of the tune. And then you've inserted, and this is back when we listened to CDs in our cars or wherever, you know, and they would skip.
I remember you.
And that feeling of a skipping, scratched CD.
Said, I love you too.
to think that you developed this live? It was such a funny relationship between like the organic rendering of the song and technology and a kind of comment on technology.
I remember too.
It's a little bit Dada, but it also relates to the content of the piece. That's why I chose I Remember You. Because for me, memory or remembering somebody or something can sometimes have this very, very echoey kind of effect in your head. You think about this parking lot in Akron, Ohio. Why am I thinking about this? It doesn't move and it just keeps flickering. So that's why I chose that song. But the idea came from listening to a CD and it started to skip, but it skipped slightly differently every time in that same place. I thought it was sort of, for me, it was like a doorway into the cellular structure of life or something. It was so weird. And yeah, it's like, what if the CD skip gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it is actually the thing that you're in.
Yes.
So that was sort of the idea behind my arrangement. I always find it, now it's not happening anymore, but when you're in a restaurant and there's a skipping CD, nobody notices. Have you noticed that?
I've had that experience.
Like, nobody's actually
listening to the music. They hear it as just
I think it's fantastic.
I mean, you turned it into music. I mean, it's funny also now, whatever it is, 20 years later, because I think that's maybe 20 years old.
Yeah, origami, yeah.
That it also has a new layer of memory attached to it because it's evocative of a time when I listened to CDs, and I don't listen to CDs anymore.
I don't even know if half of the younger kids understand what that is.
Yeah. I know. I have my CDs and it's a point of contention with my wife who's like, okay, we want to downsize. Let's start with the CDs. They're not in this room, but they're in
another. Be careful because I downsize too much and I'm missing some CDs. I have all of Sheila's CDs, of course, but some stuff you can't find online.
I know. I think some of your work you can't find online.
Yes, like my solo record, Anteroom. Why? Why? Come on.
Why can you not find it online?
I need to talk to the record label. It's a beautiful, beautiful record of just overdubs, no lyrics. It's an ambient 47-minute piece that goes through, different sections, but it has, it's like an ambient cloud that moves through different weather. And I don't understand why this is nowhere to be found. I guess on YouTube, maybe?
Maybe.
Yeah.
If I did wait to talk to you because I wasn't sure when, I actually think, speaking as Love and Anger, this record that you're putting out right now is coming out, was a good time to wait because it does kind of cover a lot of the ground that we've been talking about, including some of the collaborations. Ben Maunder is on it.
It lay buried here. It lay deep inside me. It's so deep, I don't think that I can speak about it. It could take me all my life, or it could only take a moment to tell you what I'm feeling. 'Cause I don't know if I'm ready yet. You come walking into this room like you're walking into my arms, and what would I do without you?
So there are some pieces of it that have been sort of following you through your career, and then there's also some newer stuff too. You decided to work with Ulysses Owens.
Yes, Owens Jr.
Jr.
The third. He invited me to do this project called Songs of Freedom, which was the music of Joni Mitchell, Nina Simone, and Abby Lincoln. And it was with three different singers, originally Dee Dee Bridgewater, Alicia Olatuya, and myself. And so we toured that for a couple of years. It was a very fruitful project and super fun. And Ulysses and I were, instant friends. And we kept our friendship going.
And he had heard you on your Kate Bush record originally. Yeah. That's what he liked.
And so we kept hanging out and he showed me how to smoke cigars. And
are you good at it?
No. Not yet. So we, you know, and then he's at one of those hangs, he said, I would love to produce a record for you. I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
I was too shy to ask.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, I would always loved his playing, his producing. So it was really great.
Was there pre-production involved in terms of thinking of, no?
No, we just selected the repertoire. Well, that, I guess that is pre-production.
Sure.
And then there was on, Ulysses came over to my house and we sort of looked through my repertoire and I said, you know, I have this arrangement of Mighty Reel, but I don't know what to do with it and yada, yada, yada. And within 10 minutes, him and I were just like rearranging everything. It is so important, and this goes back to what we've been talking about, community and support.
Yeah.
Somebody say, no, that's good.
Yes.
That is good.
Yes.
Why are you discarding that? I'm like, this is nothing. This is a little bit doopy, booty, booty. It's a little bass line. He's like, no, that's great. And if Ulysses says it's great, I believe it.
Yes. I mean, speaking of Mighty Reel, like, you know, one of the things I take from that is, yes, I might be making challenging work. Yes, I might be making work that has a meaning that you don't always understand, but I also have spent some time on the dance floor. I like popular music.
When we're out there dancing on the floor, darling, and I feel like I need some more, and I feel your body close to mine, and I know my love, it's about that time, makes me feel Mighty Reel, makes me feel, you make me feel, Mighty Reel.
I love popular music,
and
I have the highest respect for people that can write a song like you can, you know, that has shape and has a build and has intention from A to B to C, like through the end. Like it, I have nothing but respect for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the Mighty Reel and there's other more.
Frank Ocean.
Yeah, Frank Ocean, which was a suggestion that came out of Ulysses and me at the same time, pretty much, because I love that record. I love Frank Ocean. And that song was just 1 year of just listening to that song. So we wanted to do that.
Smoking good, rolling solo. It's hell on earth and the city's on fire. In the hell is heaven. There's a bull and a matador dueling in the sky.
I mean, also, Lennon McCartney, you know, like that, there's nothing more structured and classic than revisiting Beatles material.
Yeah. I went a little bit, you know, I took the scalpel and just
yes, you did.
Cut it into pieces.
Hey, you've got to hide your love away. Hey, you've got to hide your love away.
That came out of a project from the Frankfurt Jazz Festival that I did with Ben Maunder, actually. And Julia Hultzmann Trio.
Yes.
And we did a whole Beatles program that unfortunately we didn't get to record for ECM, but I don't think Manfred is a big Beatles cover kind of. So we did, that was, you know, my contribution or one of the contributions. And I just wanted to record it.
Yes.
Giving voice to different ideas of song, basically, on this record, the different song forms and different songwriters and different eras, obviously.
How important is it from a career standpoint to be making records for you?
I have been making records.
Yeah, a lot of records.
Yeah, and they're sort of disappearing a little bit. And that's what I'm saying. Like doing something now, if I were to start now, I would just like, no, screw this. I'm working at Starbucks. It is so hard to get anybody to pay attention to anything, including myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not better than anybody. And get away from their phones and come to a concert, impossible. You know, when was the last time I laid down or sat down and listened to an album? I can tell you, because it was Jan Slater's Glimmer, which I cannot stop listening to. But that was an album where I was like, I can't do anything else. I have to take everything in because every detail is so important to me. But for the most part, we consume music on the go.
Yes.
So music has become a commodity that serves us. Like, I need to have more energy, so I'm listening to this. I need to relax. I need to listen to this now. So the music is serving my daily routine, which is fine. But rarely does one sit down and say, what has this person to say? What is, you know, can I, let me see what they have got to say.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I wonder if you see it as a change in your students, that they have a different, like I've often felt that YouTube and streaming, there's a before and an after.
Yes.
We talk about not having CDs anymore or whatever, but, you know, having had to go and find the Al Jarreau and the John Hendricks and the Mark Murphy and the Manhattan Transfer record, and each one of those records represents a rite of passage that you had to go through, mm-hmm. as opposed to living in a world where you could sort of spend 30 seconds kind of dealing with all of them. And, oh, okay, I see. Okay.
Yeah, I know Betty Carter. I listened to half of her video. Yeah. Sure, that exists, but I also see that the skill level is enormously high right now. I don't even know where to put that.
Yeah.
Like, why are there so many incredibly skilled singers with voices for days?
Yeah.
It's really incredible. And I'm happy about that. I'm happy for singers to sound better than ever. But when do you ever really take something in fully? When you buy an LP as a, you know, you have that LP and that's your new LP. And whether you really love it, you listen to it just because you have no more money to buy another one.
Yes.
And the store is far away. The constant access also allows us to not really listen because we're already thinking about, oh, I don't like this so much. What am I going to listen to next?
And in fact, not liking something is as informative as liking something.
Exactly. And oftentimes you can learn so much more from something that is not that good.
Yeah.
Or is not even liking, but that's flawed.
Yes.
Then you see what's not working.
Yes.
When something is absolutely perfect, you can't really figure out what you need to work on.
Yes. Right. And what does that mean to you?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so you talk about the technical level. On the other hand, it seems a big part of what you work on with people is technique.
Yes, because I feel that when you technique only in the sense of discovering or getting to know your own voice.
Mm.
I don't teach technique that will make you sound like you have technique.
Mm.
To me, that's the worst kind of singing.
Yeah.
So I just want, if your voice is in a place where you can move around and sing pretty much any register variation in any vowel, so the independence of vowel sound and register, then you can do a lot of things. And then it's not up to me to say, oh, with that voice, you can only sing bossa nova, or with that, you know, that you should be singing pop.
That's very funny that you say that. When I was, briefly, I was taking voice lessons with Jamie Lenhart, and she said to me, right now, you can sing bossa nova. That's exactly what she said to me.
It's so funny. I just texted with Jamie. It's her birthday today.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
I'll send her a message.
Yeah. So for me, learning how to navigate it through my voice in different registers made it possible for me to sing in so many different contexts.
Yeah.
And I say this to a lot of my singers that are searching. I say there are many, many, many contemporary composers, whether it's atonal or tonal or minimal or whatever you want, that are looking for singers that can sing in tune, sing with and without vibrato, and know how to improvise or change parameters of sorts. That is a skill that most jazz singers have.
Mm-hmm.
And why not put it to good use?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to sing All of Me all day long.
Yes. Well, so now this is a major question, and I think it probably applies in many realms in contemporary jazz, improvised music, whatever. But specific to singers, it's a big question. For years, the expectation was, or the assumption was, oh, you're a jazz singer. Okay, so you know all the tunes and you can improvise over all these tunes. Like, that was one version of what the job was or what the expectation was. I get the sense that you're exploring a completely different version of what that is.
Because I like to do different things
and
I like to work in different contexts and with different composers.
Yeah.
I did a piece that's now being remounted with David Lang, who wrote a monodrama, and it's string quartet and voice, and it's like there was a set, there were costumes. I had to learn the whole staging.
I saw one video, and it deals with suicide, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Note to a Friend.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love doing stuff like that in between concert or recording stuff. This is, to me, that it, all of these different branches inform or are connected to the same tree trunk or inform each other.
Yeah.
So what I do with Meredith informs what I do with Riley or what I do with Kneebody or, you know, back and forth. So these things keep my creative spirits alive. Yeah.
What is your actual just maintenance routine?
Since COVID? Watching a lot of Netflix.
Uh-huh. What do you watch on Netflix?
I thought today was Friday, and I started to get so excited because of Great British Bake Off, or the Great British Baking Show was going to be releasing another episode today, but no.
That was our COVID routine.
Oh, my
was wonderful
God.
In our family.
I think it's one of my favorite shows ever, and I don't even bake or cook at all.
The thing that I think is wonderful about it is that it seems to point to like a real innocence, like in humanity.
I totally agree. And I wonder if it's manufactured sometimes and if it's curated a little bit.
Yeah.
But the idea of people being loving to each other and supporting each other in this endeavor that is completely wonderful and not being in competition and not winning a prize, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I know this chair gets a little uncomfortable after a while.
No. I like it, actually. It makes me able to sit.
Yes, sit properly.
Cross-legged. So my maintenance is to sing as much as I can. Sometimes that is not always possible because I'm teaching a lot and that's tiring. But singing, I've noticed that when I'm on the road, my voice gets better and better.
Because you sing a couple hours a day.
I sing more. I sing a couple hours a day.
Yeah.
And sound check and... After a while, I don't have to warm up. Everything is in place.
Yeah.
So I try to keep that, whether it's singing through songbooks or singing along with stuff. And sometimes it's listening, sitting and listening, which I've started to do with my students as well. Because on their own, they're listening and on the subway or something. Yeah. So really sitting down and listening to the same cut once, twice, three times.
Mm. So you'll do that. You'll listen to the same cut three times with students. Also, listening in a group is a different experience.
So true. Having a listening party.
Yeah. Or as you said tonight, you're going to get together with students and go hear music.
Yeah. We definitely are not listening in the same way anymore. Yeah. Also, if we want to equate listening to music to listening to each other, we don't listen to each other anymore very much. Like most discourse is put output. And the bigger and the louder the output... you know, the more likes it gets.
Yeah.
But listening is as an acquired skill, is something you learn.
Yeah.
And back to Rosie, this is dedicated to Rosie. I was sitting with Rosie that she came to visit.
Yeah.
And the way she listened to, she wanted to know what I was up to, which was also very endearing. And she sat there and listened, and I saw her listening. She wasn't thinking about what she gonna say next. No, she was listening. I was like, wow.
Mm-hmm. This is what it feels like.
10 gold stars.
Yeah.
That's really, really special.
Okay, so singing as much as you can. What about just physicality, diet, exercise, all that stuff, sleep?
Yes. Physicality. I go to the gym every day.
Yeah.
And I eat healthy and all that stuff.
Yeah. Just normal, basic.
Yeah.
Be good to yourself.
Yeah.
Drinking?
No.
Okay.
COVID has taught me to embrace cocktails, which I really love.
Yeah.
So, I could do less.
Couldn't we all?
Yeah, social lubricant.
I understand that you and your husband have essentially lived separately for years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a kind of choice that, you know, a certain kind of family can make. Just in terms of talking about how your life is organized, would you be open to talking about why that works and how that works?
Well, we didn't know that it worked until we realized it works really well. So when we met, we didn't live in the same area, even in New York. I was in Chelsea, he was in Flatiron. And then after we dated for a while, he said, oh, there's an apartment across the hall from me that's empty. And why don't you move in? I moved in. That was ideal. I think it was like 7 years or something. that we had that arrangement, and I could run across, you know, in my pajamas, and
yeah,
if I forgot something. And it was great because his apartment is too small for two people.
Uh-huh.
But it's rent stabilized, and it's a great apartment. So then they changed the building, turned over to luxury condos. They could not evict him, so he's still there. But they kicked me out, so I had to live somewhere else. And we realized, and it took us a while to fess up to it. We're like, you know what? This is actually really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
you have to have a very confident,
yes,
and self-assured person that is not threatened by you not spending Friday evening over or something like that.
Yes.
You know, if you say, you know what, I'm not feeling, I just want to be by myself. A lot of people would think, oh, but if you love me,
yes,
you'll be here on Friday nights. Like, there's none of that.
Yeah.
And that took a while. That's not, you don't start there.
Yeah.
At the first couple of years, like, oh, we have to spend every minute together. Of course.
Yeah.
You just got to make that bond. And then after a while, you're like, you know, I really want you to come over.
Yes.
Come over now.
Yes.
Or no.
Yes. Well, you know, as you describe it, I think some of it is also real estate specific in the sense that, like, if we lived in a place where you had a big house and each person had this space that they could go to, it's possible you would be even less connected because you'd be in your own space, you know?
Yeah. And you would resent that person because you hear them flush the toilet like four times a day or something. You're like, whatever.
And my parents' marriage was supported by this idea that they called, how can I miss you if you won't go away? Because my dad was on the road all the time. And so it was always like, it was always another homecoming.
You know? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that keeps it fresh.
Yeah.
And we don't have kids. Yeah. And so we don't have pets.
Yeah.
So we can do that.
Yeah.
And whenever I say, oh, we have two different apartments, a lot of straight people are like, oh my God, I wish we could do that.
Traditionally, we're supposed to live in this way and then raise these kids together.
Yeah. And if you don't, then this, that, and the other. You don't love me enough, or you're not giving me this, what I need. I've realized that when you love somebody deeply, it's not about what you get, but it's what you give.
Mm.
So when I hear these reality TV shows, I need somebody who is this, and I want, and I deserve this, and I deserve that, and I deserve somebody who treats me like this and that and the other.
Yeah.
It's not about that. It's about what can you give to the other person? And if Preston wants his space, because I love him so much, I give it to him, then he should have it. And if he just watches Netflix without me, and that is fine.
Yes.
That doesn't mean he doesn't love me. But I'm telling you, it took us years to admit to it.
Yeah.
And it's something you sort of traipse towards, and then you check in and see, you too, you're okay? If I don't, okay. And so forth. It's something you do together. It's not something you just make a rule of.
Right. Which is also a lesson to be learned, that, like, even in very long relationships, rules, you know,
change. They must. Yeah. Otherwise, you're stuck.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, again, tell me if you don't want to talk about this, that you live in artist-subsidized housing.
Mm-hmm.
You were on the waiting list for 2 decades.
Yes, 23 years. Yeah, I'm very lucky, and it relieves a sense of, I have to continually shovel money into my bank account to pay the rent, and then it's gone the end of the month. And I have done that successfully without going into debt, but there was a time when I was younger when I put my rent on my credit card.
Sure.
And only because my apartment was burnt down because of the landlord's rewiring fault that I got a little bit of money to pay off my debt. And from then on, from 97, I've never been in debt again. But other than that, it's been shoveling money into the account and throwing it away to rent.
Yes. I mean, the reason I think it's important to talk about it is, again, because people don't often talk about this aspect of it. And I think also when you talk to people about being an artist, you know, there's so much mystery around it. What does that mean? What do you do? What is your life like? How do you know? And the other thing is, what are the realities of actually surviving this way?
It's hard work.
Yeah.
I never call myself an artist. Never. I think it's a little pompous, actually.
It's my father says the same thing. He's always said, I don't know what that means. I don't accept it. I don't.
The other people can say that about me if they want to. Totally. I embrace it. But this, like, I'm an artist. Therefore, what? It's you have to show up. You have to work hard. You have to be reliable. You have to. It's the continuous showing up that's really, really tough sometimes. Like when you have the choice of not showing up, to show up.
Kurt Elling said the same thing to me the other day. He said, a poet cannot call themselves a poet. Somebody else can call them a poet.
Exactly. Well, he would know. He's really good with poetry. Yeah.
But this is, it's the sort of the same thing. It doesn't serve you necessarily.
Yeah, but I don't know. It just seems pompous to me. And whether it's art or not is not for me to decide. And then we get into this, what is art? Ugh, who cares?
I think of Laurie Anderson.
Yeah.
I wonder if she would be somebody who would say, who you've worked with, would describe herself as an artist.
She would say probably the same thing that I just said.
Yeah.
Or she would have a way smarter answer. I mean, Laurie is one of the smartest people you'll ever meet.
Yeah.
I saw her the other day. I saw her with the New York Times in her hand. I'm like, you're reading the actual paper? Yes, I am. It's like, of course you are.
I'll trust you on that. That the people that are out here making this work are not necessarily.
I mean, Meredith is a really good example. Yeah. I would call her an artist, no question.
Yes.
Of course. And she would probably say that. So, but she's not going around, I'm an artist. Oh, I'm so precious. I'm so enlightened. And that's just, who needs that?
What about social media?
Everybody says, oh, you have to have social media. And I don't know. I find it, if you can find a way to sort of ironically comment on it in some ways, the posts that I do about gigs or the music are most under-liked. It's usually the personal weird stuff that people respond to. And I don't blame them. You know, self-promotion. You have to find a way to self-promote yourself through another alley in some way. And I'm just like tired of it. You know, like, oh, you have to find a clever way to entice people to listen to your music. I don't know. I've said to Rosie and Sabeth Perez, my other wonderful student and many other students, I said, what you don't do on the internet is also a message. I don't know if that is even helpful, but if you're not doing what everybody else is doing and following everybody's advice to do this sizzle reel and this, the other, that also has a message. I think. I don't know.
I'm sure that it does. I'm sure that it does. I mean, sure, it's what you don't do says as much about who you are as what you do.
A good example is when a famous jazz musician has died, everyone comes out of the woodworks with a photo with their arm around the dead person.
Right, so everybody's trying to attach themselves to the legacy of somebody.
Yeah.
Yes. What are you learning from your students? I feel like you must be staying in touch with younger people, younger singers, younger. Yeah. You know, what are you learning?
What do I learn is persistence, resilience, an incredible dedication to their craft. The craft is through the roof. I'm not joking. This is the best singing I've heard since I started teaching. Mm. I mean, everyone around me is incredible. All my students are really, really good. Exceptionally good. Yeah. So I don't know where that comes from, whether it's the internet or this era of the resurgence of embodied singing or, you know, full voices again. Yeah. It's nice.
When you came to work with Sheila, did you go to conservatory here?
I went to Manhattan School.
You did?
Yes. And then I switched because I couldn't afford it anymore. Yeah. Went to City College where she was teaching.
Uh-huh. It's interesting that you say even back then that you couldn't afford it anymore because I know that there's financing and scholarships and all.
And Sheila had gotten me a scholarship, but it still wasn't enough.
But think about it today.
Oh my God. And then you have a diploma as a jazz singer. Good luck on ya.
Does that burden you when you walk into the room or you're doing your job?
I was the same. I didn't care one bit.
Yeah.
I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. That's how it should be. You should go into the school thinking, of course I'm going to make it.
Huh.
I'm that good. You have to have that delusion. Otherwise, don't even start. And then you can go someplace with it. So no, I don't feel guilty. First of all, they're all really good singers for the most part. And I don't, you know, of course it shouldn't cost that much. That's a whole other political discussion. But no, they're all great. Go for it.
Right. So it's not like you have any sense. I mean, even my wife is a yoga teacher. She and I sometimes talk about the sense of responsibility that we have. Imposter syndrome meets responsibility of like, I want people to get their money's worth, even if they paid.
That's a good point.
You know, whatever it is, because they're paying so much, you know?
And yeah. I realized as a teacher, you cannot, I'm not a library of everything. Mm. Like, I can teach everything that I know, but I don't know everything. Nobody knows everything. So it's also the student's responsibility to draw out knowledge from other people, not just from, I think this might be a problem in today's teaching. And again, this is probably another discussion, but students come to the teacher thinking they're going to a store to buy something and then they have it. And then they are that.
Yes.
Instead of what can I get from this person and how do I work on myself to implement it or make myself better?
Yes.
It's less about that. It's about what do I get from you?
Yeah.
And oftentimes, or sometimes, students will not take my advice because they think that they know what they need.
Yes. Well, but again, hearing a record that you don't like.
Yes.
Even if it's not that it's not good, it's just you don't like it, will tell you something about what you do like.
So yes.
Getting advice from a teacher that you disagree with will help you understand what you agree, what you believe.
Yeah. And sometimes that rub is defining you.
Yes.
That's very important. Sometimes I feel that that's shutting down, like it's disqualifier for learning. I think that's exactly right. A lot of singers don't know what they want to do, but they know what they don't want to do.
Yeah.
So by process of elimination, like a sculptor, cut away what you don't want to do.
Yeah.
And then you're left with what you want to do or what you're doing, actually. Yes.
The other thing that I hear in your teaching, and I heard from Rosie when she was describing it, was a sense from you that you don't necessarily know which part of yourself you're going to deliver until you see who you're delivering it to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this, not all people need to receive the same information at the same time.
Of course. Yeah, it's bespoke. That's why it's so expensive.
Yeah, right, that makes sense. I love talking to you about your teaching, but you're also constantly creating and working. And, you know, I mean, this record is coming out. It was made a year and a half ago. You're obviously working on another record already.
But I'll tell you one thing. First of all, kudos to Ulysses.
Yeah.
I was at a standstill with this record in January or February, and Ulysses came over. My husband and Ulysses listened to what I had done thus far, especially with solo, and I didn't know if it was any good. And they both sat there and was like, this is great. What are you, why are you even hesitating?
Yeah.
And fix this, and we're going to do this, and we're going to wrap it up here, and blah, 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 blah. And solo, the Frank Ocean piece, is much longer in its original. I couldn't figure out how to do the second part. And Ulysses said, just do the first part. It's fine. It sounds great the way it is.
So had you recorded with Ulysses and Matt and...
Yeah, this was all done already.
And then you took it home and you played with it and you layered it and you did all the things.
I was so isolated in this process. And some of it I thought was good. And some of it was like, ugh, once a year, this isn't stupid. It's the same thing. And so, you know, it came to a standstill. And it was only because somebody said, no, this is good. Theo. And then I'm like, you know what? I thought it was okay only.
Yeah.
And then through a few changes, it became something I really can stand behind, obviously. But it takes a village to make a record.
You clearly seek a certain kind of collaboration.
Yes.
But you also have a thing that is very much you that you do. You know, you chose to work with Ulysses on this record, whatever, but then you went off into your corner and you explored alone and then brought it back to him, and which seems like a great balance between allowing your, you know, other light into the room and then...
Now it looks great, but in the process, and I say this to young singers, it is really hard sometimes and it gnaws at you and you're just like, oh, I'm doing the same thing over and over again. It's my, and there's nothing... And you start to just eat at yourself. It's through those times that we have to be supportive of each other.
Yes.
Right? Otherwise, you're just going to self-destruct. And little by little, you don't want to do it again. And you don't want to be singing. And you don't want to write a song. And you don't. So that was hard. That was not easy. It sounds really good now.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of this record. I hope it does, you know, it does get people to listen to it.
Yes.
I want it to be a record that people can listen to.
Yeah, what is success in that sense for you? What would, when people listen to it.
Yeah. When people say, oh, I have this record, I love listening to it.
Yeah.
It is nice to know that people respect you and think that you're doing important work and all this highfalutin pious stuff. But if people say, oh my God, I listened to that record yesterday, I'm like, that's the best. Maybe I'm in the wrong field for that, but sometimes you make a record or you're on something and you forget about it. And then years later, somebody says, oh, I love this. Da, 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 da.
Well, I was thinking about that when I brought up I Remember You, because
yes,
I was thinking this is an arrangement that you did over 20 years ago.
Yes.
And I just discovered it yesterday and I had a reaction to it.
Yeah.
Something that you were thinking about doing 20 years ago, two decades ago.
I had a student, a young kid, come to me after a masterclass at NYU, a composition masterclass. And he would not shut up about that arrangement. He said, I wrote my paper on it.
Yeah.
It changed my life. And blah, 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 blah. I'm like, what? This little thing? This arrangement got me downgraded from a 5-star downbeat review to a 4.5-star. The reviewer said so because he thought it was a gimmick and it was, he didn't really get it, which is exactly the point. I mean, it really hit the target audience, which is narrow jazz thinking. I wanted to put a little needle in that and go outside of that.
Yeah, because jazz also, especially jazz singing, exists often for us to have dinner.
Yes.
Too.
Yes.
And your arrangement is not good dinner music.
No, it's not jazz entertainment, jazz theater. Yeah.
Regardless of what it is or isn't, I appreciate you so much for spending some time with me and sharing all these thoughts, Theo Blackman.
Thank you for having me.
And I am less intimidated by you, but I still continue to be in awe of you, and thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. Bye.
There he was, my friend Theo Blackman. What a wonderful person. In the spirit of community, and since it's been determined that this episode is dedicated to Rosie Bolan, here's a little taste of a recent single by Rosie called Paint Me by Numbers. I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.